Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week, a review of The Radio Listener's Guide, new for 1992, a documentary about commercial radio in Ireland. Multiple D microphones, what are they and why are they useful? All about a 1976 film on Radio Caroline, revisited in a new TV series, and moans about American television. Back to the golden sound of vintage transistors. Whatever next, we investigate. Plus, more book reviews and your letters. It's Sparks, every Monday and Tuesday on Radio Facts. 6205, 12255, and now 3910 to the winter in the UK.
Radio waves. you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck, and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherland receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477, or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
A blast from the past. Zenon TOP road tests a modern vintage equalizer from Professional Audio Systems Technology. Surely the most commonly held criticism ever levelled at a mixing desk is that its EQ is a bit harsh, basic, or plain old not very good. Peculiarly enough, desk praise is often also expressed with reference to the same section of the channel strip, with expressions like musical, warm, and superb manifesting themselves as the stuff that engineer interviews are made of. Sound engineers and producers continue to appreciate the particular qualities of Neve equalizers, built in the 1960s and 70s, made all the more attractive by the fact that they are now extremely rare, or wired into desks in control rooms that you can't get into without booking well in advance. Professional Audio Systems Technology has recognized this need and builds what amounts to Neve 80 series equalizers from the original components to the original specifications. Even the skills of some of the original and now retired wiring personnel have been enlisted. Ex-Neve employee and founder Steve Butterworth worked on this series of desk while he was with Neve, and is now independently established as one of the foremost rebuilders and customizers of 80 series consoles. He also owns one of the largest collections of spares, components and bits and pieces for these desks. The approach is one of authentic, discrete technology. If the vintage sound is desired, then it cannot be mimicked, it must be recreated. Much is always being made of the unique sound of the EQ units of this vintage, and this translates most obviously into an almost complete inability to make a signal sound disgusting, no matter how much boost is applied. At worst, things start to sound inappropriate, a far cry from the razor-edged wince that can be induced by some modern equalizers. As a corrective tool, the past EQ can be devastating. Using 2 units in series on a mono cleanup job allowed me to boost and enhance the original dirty signal on the first unit before bracketing with the filters and dipping out offensive bands with the second. It's surprising just how close to the grave some sources can come and still be redeemed. Modern equalizers use integrated circuits. The past EQ uses transistors because it's based on the 1960s and 1970s technology that remains so desirable. Without wishing to become too pedantic about vintage sound, but drawing attention only to the aspect of authenticity, a vintage mic strapped to a transistorized piece of outboard equipment like the past EQ is, in honesty, a more genuine starting point to work from. A lot of producers and engineers appreciate this difference, and that's why this unit is in such demand. Part of a review of a new equalizer in Audio Media magazine. Onto a letter from Arty Prokhorov, writing from Moscow, in, well, Russia it should be these days. Dear friends, I am a radio amateur, and I've been interested in pirate radio since 1990. I'd like to thank you for your excellent Sparks programme. My friends and I sometimes hear it. Especially for the programme, I want to tell you that I am DJ of pirate radio station RSR, Romantic Space Radio. My station is relayed and broadcast via BWBI, Radio Without Borders International, the station which is located somewhere in Moscow. The musical format of RSR Radio's Romantic Space Radio is electronic and acoustic music, like Jean-Michel Jarre, Tangerine Dream, Space, etc. The address is P.O. Box 29, Moscow, 109444 in Russia. Well, any excuse to play some Tangerine Dream. I'll tell you that you're listening to Sparks. Our address, if you'd like to write to us, I sincerely hope you do, is Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. If you'd like to write to us, you can expect in return a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. Before that, you must send 50 pence, $1 or 3 international reply coupons. However, even if you can't stretch to that, I guarantee to read your letter out on air and say hello to you. Thanks to R.T. Prokhorov for that letter from Moscow. Moving on to a documentary programme that was on recently on Irish RTE1. They start talking about the recent closure of Century.
Now, the country's first independent national broadcaster had been on the air for just over 2 years. The absence of a national alternative to RTE leaves the government with another of the key aims of its broadcasting legislation unfulfilled. It also deprived most of the independent local stations of their news service, though that need is being fulfilled for the moment by the Dublin station 98FM. For the private radio sector and its backers, the future is unclear for the moment. Dennis Barnett looks at the situation, national and local level.
Despite the collapse of the flagship Century, it's clear that independent local radio at least can succeed, and in some cases succeed well.
From the city to the valleys, the mountains to the coast,
we know our audience, and our audience knows us, and we are very accessible to our audience. And when we sit down to plan, particularly the access programming which goes on here, we are very aware of the fact of striking a balance between the city and the county in terms of even how we structure our competitions, and that we invite at specific times of the day listeners from specific parts of the whole franchise area.
Billy McCarthy, program controller of WLR, Waterford Local Radio, whose 51% local listenership exposure or reach makes it one of the most listened to local radio stations. The average local radio exposure figure is 36%. But Billy McCarthy acknowledges that, unlike many other local stations, WLR had a firm base in which to build after 10 years as a pirate operation.
Initially, in providing us with an existing audience, I think that was very important, because the loyalty that pre-existed the granting of the licence was immense, particularly within the city, and I would say within a radius of, say, 7 to 15 miles of the city. Mm-hmm. When we closed down as pirates, they sort of honked their horns and nearly cried with us, you know, so that's there. It was important to give us a base on which to build listener loyalty.
The main story this hour, an attempt to refloat the ship aground on the Waterford coast has failed. WLRFM News, I'm Paul Collins. Good afternoon. An attempt to refloat the stricken Norwegian freighter, the Matrician...
Like nearly all the other local radio stations, WLR depended on Century for its syndicated national and international news to supplement its own local coverage. Dion Breen is WLR's head of news.
Century leaves a gap for local radio in general, because most stations can't afford to have fully staffed newsrooms. And we have to look now at providing an independent, I would feel, independent service, and there are two major points to be addressed there. The first one is the cost of providing such a service, and the second one would be how that service would be transmitted throughout the country. And in connection with the talk of redirection of some of the license fee to local radio, I would feel that this is the area where that license fee would be directed to, because there are major costs involved, transmission costs particularly, and also the staffing of an independent newsroom. And I would feel that the minister would perhaps be looking, I hope he would be looking at this as a priority. And the much used level playing pitch would be leveler if we had a certain segment of license fee money to fulfill our statutory requirements to provide 20% news and current affairs. I would say to the minister, if he is going to direct money to stations, that he should target specific areas. I don't think the money should be just handed to stations to perhaps prop up those who are not commercially sound and economically viable. I would think it should be specifically directed towards the provision of news and current affairs, perhaps towards the very high transmission costs.
This is your Radio Kilkenny, community radio in action.
Your kind of radio.
Good morning. Come right in. We've got the usual mixed bag this morning. Later on, Elaine Shaw will be joining us and we'll be speaking about natural healing. Elaine Bulger will be along with a little advice on consumer affairs, and we've got our weekly Garda report too.
Tom Dowling.
Nice to have your company. And of course, the best music on Radio Kilkenny.
Oh, the shock, baby.
While those at Waterford would argue that they are not, like some other stations, in dire need of a licence fee subvention, just across the county bounds, community station Radio Kilkenny has struggled since start-up 2 years ago. Jimmy Brett, a local businessman and Fianna Fáil County Councillor, is Radio Kilkenny's chairman. Here, like elsewhere, realism has replaced early over-ambition.
Well, most local stations started out from the belief this was going to be a very lucrative business. But I mean, I know from my own experience of working in RT that radio is a very expensive business. We had to look at our cost structure here in Radio Kilkenny, and it meant that we had to change effectively our management structure. And we went from a fully professional management team over to a voluntary management team.
That move cut around £3,000 off the monthly overheads, but the station still needed a huge local raffle to help it survive.
It was not a raffle, firstly. It was a listener's draw. Now, some radio stations and television stations have the luxury of a license fee, which the plain people of Ireland contribute to. Now, in my view, local radio, properly run, is producing and delivering a large element of public service broadcasting. In Radio Kilkenny, I think we have a huge public service output. We are getting no contribution from the taxpayers of Ireland or from the government. In fact, on the contrary, every £100 which is collected by us, the first £21 goes to VAT, and a further £15 to £16 goes to pay various levies. So I see nothing wrong with us organising a listener's draw to substitute for a licence fee, which I think we should have some of anyway, and any properly inspired legislation in the future will have to incorporate some allocation of licence fee in line with the level of public service broadcasting being done.
He says Radio Kilkenny and others has as much right to a cut of the licence fee as RTE.
I think it should go towards stabilising the finances of all stations, but particularly the capital side of it. I don't think it should be seen as something to throw in to balance the books in the short term. I think there should be very strict criteria attaching to that money. I think every station should do a form of self-assessment, including RTE, by the way, to assess our level of what must be called public service broadcasting. But it's important for the IRTC to redefine what is public service broadcasting. And let us all do our audits and let the IRTC monitor it, and that any license fees should be paid in relation to that on a pro rata basis.
A redefinition of public service broadcasting will come too late to help Century Radio. The start-up, announced on air by Terry Wogan, heralded a new era in Irish broadcasting and, for the first time, threw up a serious competitor to the RTE monopoly.
Century Radio. And I'd now like to call on the Minister for Communications and Justice, Mr. Ray Burke, to officially open Century Radio.
While the expression historic occasion is a most overused one these days, there's no doubt that it's correctly applied on this occasion. We're celebrating the involvement of the private sector in national commercial broadcasting and the creation of a new, vibrant, competitive broadcasting environment.
But the dream of the then Minister for Communications, Ray Burke, was to be short-lived. When the end came last week, it was brutally sudden.
The headline at 6 o'clock. Century Radio has announced in the last few minutes that the station is closing down with immediate effect and the company has been put into liquidation.
Steve Shanahan is media director of QMP Advertising. For advertisers and their clients, the Century launch was a catalogue of unrealistic targets.
There was a bit of surprise in the sense of a friend who's had cancer maybe for the last 2 years, whom you've met 2 weeks ago, and he tells you he's fully recovered, and then 2 weeks later he suddenly is dead. In that sense, it was a surprise. But really, this has been anticipated within the industry for quite a long time.
He says the minister should act quickly to ease the pre-Christmas advertising logjam in the wake of the Century collapse.
I think there's immediate action he can take. He could lift the minutage restriction that he's imposed on RTE right now for the rest of November and December to alleviate the real problems of taking care of the money that will not be spent on Century coming up to Christmas. And there's still a number of clients who want to advertise on RTE. He could solve that problem immediately by allowing RTE to return to their original minutage for this immediate period coming up to Christmas.
It's widely expected that a cut of anything from 12.5% to 15% of RTE licence fee money diverted to the independent sector will be one of the central planks of Seamus Brennan's proposed review of the Broadcasting Act. That means upwards of £7 million a year will be dispensed by the IRTC to the independents and the National News Service. It's against that background of hope that Oliver Barry, a one-time director of Century, is this weekend putting together a package for a new independent, but without the burden of having to provide a news service, now that a separate, independent news service is on the cards. David Davenpower is former head of news at Century.
It can be very easily argued that this should have been envisaged well before the commercial radio network went on the air. It can easily be argued, and indeed I argued it myself at the time, that for the independent commercial network to have a chance of genuine survival, that a source of news needed to be provided centrally. I think that it's now obvious that any national radio station will not have to provide its own news apart from whatever gloss it cares to put on the news that's supplied centrally. I think it's obvious that there will be a national commercial newsroom, and that will not be part of the national franchise, because while Century, while I was there, syndicated its news to the vast majority of the local radio stations, it merely recouped some 30% or 25% of the running costs of the newsroom from that syndication. So that's obviously not a viable scenario. So I think that the national commercial radio station, if one does emerge, will have no interest in setting up a newsroom in the same way that the Century newsroom was formulated.
But those who are hoping for an early solution may be disappointed.
Some elements in the cabinet feel that the whole broadcasting situation requires a more fundamental review than that offered by the proposed proposed changes to Mr. Brennan's legislation. And thus it may be that rather than the situation being accelerated by the failure of Century, that the failure of Century and the withdrawal of the TV3 franchise may lead to a more radical review of broadcasting legislation, maybe even a green paper as suggested by Fine Gael, and thus the situation may be put on the back burner for up to 9 months. We don't know. That has to be decided at Cabinet. But there is that chance that rather than Mr. Brennan's plans being brought forward in the short term, that they will be delayed pending a fundamental review of broadcasting. There is a general feeling at Cabinet that there have been too many banana skins along the broadcasting road in the last 2 years. And it is a fact that since Mr. Brennan presented his initial proposals to Cabinet for consideration, that number one, the TV3 franchise has been withdrawn, and number two, much more dramatic, the National Commercial Radio Station has collapsed and is threatened with liquidation. So I think that Mr. Brennan's cabinet colleagues, and not just the PDs, may feel that these two events merit a more fundamental re-evaluation of the situation.
The cabinet was in fact due to have discussed the matter last Thursday, but nothing was decided. All the indications are that it may yet be some time before any real progress is made, and that stations like Radio Kilkenny will continue to struggle on what they and many others see as an uneven playing pitch.
We are running a radio station here for about £15,000 per month. Now that is cheap by any standards. Now I would put it to you that the standards of broadcasting on Radio Kilkenny will compare with any other local station in this country. We cannot sustain those cost figures indefinitely. I'll be the first to admit that. But we will not increase them until such time as the revenue is there to justify it. We will not have a liquidator here in Radio Kilkenny. We won't have a receiver. We're going to be viable, and we're going to pay for things as we evolve.
Fighting talk from Radio Kilkenny in a recent documentary on RTE.
About cobalt tape for cassette mastering. Announcements at the Audio Engineering Society exhibition show that the trend towards cobalt tape for improved analog cassette performance is definitely being taken seriously by the majority of the world's tape manufacturers. Although cobalt pancakes have only been used by a few United States specialist duplicators so far, WEA Records' introduction of Digilog cassettes earlier this year, appears to have fired the imagination of duplicators looking for the quality edge with conventional analog cassettes. And Digilogs are high-quality music cassettes duplicated on ferric and cobalt tape using solid-state memory loop bins. Among the companies announcing new cobalt pancakes for high-speed and digital loop bin applications were TDK, Sunkyong and BASF. Doug Booth, industrial sales manager of TDK in the United States, noted the dynamic range problems with today's digital masters. In this situation, the only thing a duplicator can do is reduce the level and throw a lot of dynamic range out of the window in doing so. New Pro SA Cobalt, with its extraordinary dynamic range, solves this problem. That's by Carl Snape in ProSound News Europe. And another short item, a 40-year-old 3M acetate-backed tape was recently used as a source for CD release of artists including Howling Wolf, Elmore James and B.B. King.
I've been looking through and trying out the new Radio Listener's Guide for 1992. It's a handy 60-page booklet amassing all BBC national, local, independent local and Irish FM and AM frequencies. The listings also have maps showing the location of transmitter sites, such as Wenvo, which I discovered was in Wales, showing my ignorance slightly there. There's also a brief description of the type of programming on the station, the phone-in number, approximate news, weather and travel news times, the shipping forecast areas, a space to record the preset settings on your radio, or, if you prefer something older, hopefully with nice glowing valves, a wavelength to frequency conversion chart. The editors thought of everything. It's impossible to keep proper track of the pirates and not for a guide of this nature, but generally if it's on the radio, it's in this guide. A guide that brings all this information together is very useful. Although there are no transmitter powers listed for the ILR stations, quite a lot to expect with the recent diversification and gradual creeping upwards of permitted powers that has been happening recently. It's a very thorough listing, including cable and university radio shows and great attention to detail, although satellite radio is absent. The information is very up-to-date, including, for example, the licensing of SIBC in the Shetlands. The most well-known international stations are listed with basic information, and Radiofax is mentioned under miscellaneous stations as the best thing to happen to radio for the last 20 years. Although that's not the only reason I'm recommending the book. Thanks to Mr. R. Trent, by the way, for that comment. The FM, medium wave and long wave stations are also listed by frequency. Now, I've always used the Maplin catalogue for FM DXing information and have some scribbled hand-compiled charts for the AM listings. It's very handy to have them all in one book. They've also got all the names of the ILR, AM and FM frequency splits. Again, information that's not usually in such frequency listings. There are also articles on RDS, the Radio Authority, Voice of the Listener and the Sony Radio Awards. I won't give you my thoughts on some of those. However, there's also a useful feature on FM aerials that might seem just for beginners, but is worth a read. The author comments that FM radio quality should be as good as CDs and tapes. However, they fail to mention that there's one nasty, unfortunately, that no aerial can remove, the severe compression on more and more stations. I shall step down from my soapbox to thoroughly recommend the 1992 Radio Listener's Guide and hope it's available in a newsagent near you. However, if it isn't, you can order a copy of the 1992 Radio Listener's Guide by sending £3.25, which includes postage and packing, to Radio Listener's Guide, Free Post, PDQ Publishing, P.O. Box 41, Didcot, Oxfordshire, OX11 8BR, and please make the cheque payable to PDQ Publishing. Alternatively, we have 5 copies to give away. I'll set a question for this. The question is, what date did Radiofax start this year? if you are a sort of person that logs things down, that'll be an easy one for you. 5 copies of the Radio Listener's Guide to give away. The question, what date this year did Radio Fax start again? The address, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. As always, if you send us 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1, we'll send you our station card and technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. And also guarantee to read your letter out on air and say hello to you. The address? Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Fresh Radio Fax programmes start on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. And this week, Sparks is presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. Hello to Martin Keane, who writes from Howick in Roxburghshire in Scotland. Thanks for your letter, Martin. I listen to your broadcasts on 6205 kHz, he writes, and like the programme Sparks, and also the special programme A Cloakroom of Anoraks, broadcast some time ago. Remember that? Keep up the good work, and please send me your information pack. That's from Martin Keane in Howick, Roxburghshire in Scotland.
Everyone hides one desire.
We have a pun here, an article in The Guardian. It's not called Ship Shape, but Sick Shape. Andy Mayer recalls a voyage of discovery. In 1976, a small production team arrived in Ramsgate to make a film about the pirate radio ship Caroline. They found a boatman, Captain Jim, who would take them to the vessel on his boat, Delta Lady. The 1968 Marine Offences Act forbade them boarding the station, but they had brought a loudhailer through which the presenter would quiz the disc jockeys on life afloat. They checked into their hotel and met up with the film crew. Mike the cameraman, his assistant Peter, and elderly Angus, the sound recordist. The researcher went to find Captain Jim, who proved anxious to join them for a short drink. This turned out to be a series of short drinks, a meal, then back to the bar, and although Captain Jim discovered quite early that he had left his wallet behind, he didn't let it spoil his evening. On the quayside next morning, waiting for Delta Lady, the producer saw Angus being sick into a litter bin. "Is he all right?" he asked Mike. "Oh, take no notice, he's just a bad sailor." "But we're still on land. The boat's not even here yet." "Well, it's the anticipation, you see. Once he gets going, there'll be no stopping him," said the cameraman ambiguously. Delta Lady arrived, and before sailing, breakfast was prepared. The team wolfed the bacon and eggs down, although Angus confined himself to dry bread, which he ate sitting on the quayside with his back to the water. Once over the bar, the sea became choppy, and spray drenched the open area in the stern where the team had been enjoying the view. They retired to the cabin, with the exception of Angus, who refused to come inside and sat huddled against the spray with eyes tightly shut. After some minutes, Captain Jim announced that they were heading for a storm. "Better get the old bloke inside," he recommended. Mike said he didn't believe this was possible. "In that case, we'd best lash him to the deck." Captain Jim fetched some rope, and he and Mike spread-eagled Angus face down on deck and tied him securely. Soon, Delta Lady was moving in a manner which made the team regret their breakfast. The producer and researcher distracted themselves by preparing a rudimentary auto-cue for the presenter's piece to camera. They had brought a roll of plain wallpaper, and on this they wrote the speech with a felt-tip marker. The smell of ink upset the researcher, and he stepped outside.
And can you guess what happened next? More from that story in a moment.
Try tried to speak with you. Sure, your love's so true, but you won't appreciate the love we try to make. Oh, it's a got to be a shame.
Continuing with the story about a 1976 film on Radio Caroline, revisited recently in a new TV series.
Returning from being sick, he reported that the deck was awash and the sound man drowning. The producer hurried outside. The rolling of the vessel occasionally exposed Angus, and then he would take a desperate gulp of air, but most of the time he was beneath the waves. The producer soared hastily through the bonds with his Swiss Army knife and hauled the semi-conscious sound man indoors, where he threw up on the carpet. He can't stay there if he's going to keep doing that, complained the presenter. So Angus was bundled, still vomiting, into a tiny cabin underneath the wheelhouse and tied up once more to stop him tumbling about. After half an hour, the storm slackened, and the director decided to get the piece to camera done. They struggled out on deck. The rain made the ink run and blurred the presenter's spectacles. In the middle of a barely comprehensible piece, the wind whipped the wallpaper autocue overboard, and the presenter was sick to camera. Mike, peering through the camera, threw up in sympathy. The piece was abandoned. By the time they reached Radio Caroline, the sun was shining, and apart from Angus, who remained bound up in his cabin, the team had regained their equilibrium. The encounter took place successfully, and they turned for home. When they tied up in Ramsgate, two customs officers came aboard. The team chattered with one of the excise men while the other searched the vessel. Surprising how many of you chaps it takes to make a film. Yes, well, there's two on camera, one on sound. The producer's voice trailed off as he remembered someone was missing. There's something you ought to know, he began, but too late. At that moment, the other customs officer cried out in horror as he opened the door under the wheelhouse. I can explain everything, he began. That was by Andy Mayer, published in the Media Guardian. And repeats the oft-stated claim of Ronan O'Reilly that the weather is always calm around the ship. But perhaps in light of recent experience, we should say it's only effective when the ship's broadcasting.
That ride out and back sounds all too familiar. Digital film squeeze. From mid-1993, Japanese homes will be able to receive satellite-transmitted films, which have been digitally compressed into 5 minutes, according to Entertainment Made Convenient. Subscribers will rent the video of their choice by telephoning the selection and recording the transmission on a special video cassette recorder, which will decompress the data on playback. EMC2 plans to extend the service to Europe and the United States. It is setting up a UK subsidiary and will shortly announce a major UK partner. Can it be true? Thanks for the recent cards to Aidan Hughes, writing from Dublin, Adrian Childs, and Kevin Sweeney, who's in Newark in Nottinghamshire. Also thanks to John Adamson, who's in Norwich, Saxingham, Nethergate to be exact. He writes, my new TV and satellite receiver's switch mode power supplies both swamp the 6 MHz band with hash. Is this progress? Enjoying the programmes, especially the Sparks series, now with excellent signals on 3910. He listens on a Grundig Satellite 650 with a telescopic aerial. Thanks for the card, and that note about an all-too-true problem.
Firstly, there's a spanner in here. Secondly, it has the right of way. Something else is missing, sometimes sorted out and wrapped up straight away. Nothing by comparison puts thoughts straight in my mind. As I comfort myself with the will to be unkind. That is the way of every day. Betray me with a kiss. Thank you.
This week on Sparks, a review of the Radio Listener's Guide, new for 1992, a documentary about commercial radio in Ireland, multiple D microphones, what are they and why are they useful? All about a 1976 film on Radio Caroline, revisited in a new TV series, and moans about American television. Back to the golden sound of vintage transistors, whatever next, we investigate. Plus book reviews and your letters, it's all in Sparks this week.
Radio Cracker, which operated with 95 stations spread throughout the country for 3 weeks on special event licences up to Christmas, got a mention on the Radio 4pm programme.
Our religious affairs correspondent Mike Wooldridge sat in on a marathon broadcast overnight at one of the Radio Cracker stations.
Radio Cracker, South London, 100.4 FM. Tune in. Pay out.
Playing the best in indie music. Paul, Ian and Andy on South London's Radio Cracker, 100.4.
Paul, Ian and Andy sit in the most makeshift of studios in a small upper room of what was once a manor house and host an all-night show as zany as it is smooth.
And we at the Damn Fine Music Show are very pleased, proud and privileged, let's get all the P's in there, shall we, to welcome into our studio Avignon the Weather Prophet.
Hello. I do have a prophecy for the new year, which I would like to give, if I may. In 1992, the first month of 1992 will be January.
But the fun is all to raise funds.
We are here to raise money for Brazilian street children by taking your dedications and donations.
Mm. And pledges, and also, as we mentioned, the sweatshirt, we are taking bids for that. At the moment, the bidding is at £10.
It's a sweatshirt and a copy on either a CD.
There are almost 8 million kids on the street in Brazil. Alone, and they are, you know, in a very vulnerable position. So that's why we're here, and everybody's learned a lot about the situation through being involved in the project.
Phil Stokes, a local pastor and one of the organisers of the station, a strong Christian element runs through the nationwide Radio Cracker operation.
If nobody helps them, then nobody... so many kids are going to be dying every day, so I don't think that... it's just the responsibility to get the government to do something. We've got to do something as well.
But this Christmas station is also concerned about problems closer to home. Its ads are ads with a difference.
10,000 gallons of tea served every week. Hot breakfast served every morning, 365 days of the year. Second-hand clothing, medical help and good counsel, all available at our Waterloo Day Centre for Homeless People. Who are we? The London City Mission, and we have been in the capital since 1835.
We wanted to get the community involved in what we're doing, so we've actually talked about the homelessness issue, about third world giving, about addictions, various different titles and subjects that we've looked at. People have rung in, and we've had good conversations with folks over the air. It's been very, very much a community thing.
Radio Cracker, Mike Wooldridge reporting.
From the PM programme on BBC Radio 4, and then comment on Radio Cracker from Radio Orion.
I think that there'll also be a law preventing this sort of thing occurring, and also I think they shouldn't be allowed to promote religious activities on the air like this, like say come to my church tomorrow in Stourbridge. I think this is very, very reprehensible and should be stopped.
Comment there about Radio Cracker in the Midlands from Radio Orion.
I'm saying nothing. A couple of stations to be heard in the London area, Pirates. Kevin Thorpe tells me that Elite FM can be heard in the Battersea area on 98.5 FM at weekends. Not very together in their professional style, but they play good music, he says. And also, Tim Henry passes me a flyer. Listen to Base 101 FM for more information on Future Dance, Radioactive Hardcore. Future Dance is a new kick-in organisation involved in entertaining the raver. The Future Dance Posse will bring you throughout 1992 hardcore events, including many all-nighters, all of which will be legal, licensed, confirmed. Future Dance, therefore, without doubt, will be one of the spectacular exponents of the rave scene within Surrey, transforming selected venues into the future, with a PH, with massive sound systems, futuristic FX, lightning rigs, and the best in musical entertainment. Membership is required to enter all our events, with a limited amount available. Call the phone line below and you will be posted a membership application to complete. Well, in case you're interested, the number is 0836 047057. Base 101 FM, hardcore entertainment on your FM dial. Couldn't be further away from Radio Cracker, really, could it?
In The Guardian, the last word column, letter from New York, Rosemary Lamb with an urgent warning for Britain. From our point of view in New York, more channels usually means worse programming. The quality of original television drama in England is so superior to that in the United States, it makes me want to start a campaign for a uniform licensing fee to be given to the public television system in the US. The BBC's The House of Elliot could never be produced over here. Too expensive a production for too few viewers. The Men's Room could never be made here either. At least not unexpurgated, too intellectual and too sexy. The result is that we end up watching mainly three channels, public television and the Discovery Channel, which buy British programmes cheaply, 3 years late, and CNN for the news. The rest of the 29 channels are a jungle of game shows, sitcoms, violent made-for-TV movies, old films, and hideously amateur public access programming. There is, of course, the daily local news diet of increasing crime, murders, robberies, arson, and homicide counts in the inner cities, spiced with showbiz gossip. If I sound jaded with America, it is because the quality of life here is deteriorating rapidly, and as it does so, I appreciate Britain more. But I see the same things about to happen in the UK that happened here. That comment by Rosemary Lamb, who is the artistic director of the New English Stage Company, which produces British plays for American audiences. From New York.
Well, I remember every little thing as if it happened only yesterday. Walking by the lake and there was not another car in sight. And I never had a girl looking any better than you did. And all the kids at school, they were wishing they were me that night.
roll. He's gonna slide in head first. Here he comes. He's out. No, wait, safe. Safe at second base. This kid really makes things happen out there. Batter steps up to the plate. Here's the pitch, and he's going. And what a jump he's got. He's trying the third. Here's the throw. It's in the dirt. Safe at third. Holy cow, stolen base. Taking a pretty big lead out there. Almost daring him to try and pick him off. Pitcher glances over, winds up, and it's bunted, bunted down the third baseline. The suicide squeezes on. Here he comes. Squeeze play. It's going to be close. Here's the throw. Here's the play at the plate. Holy cow, I think he's going to make it.
Stop right there. Before we go any further, do you love me? Will you love me forever? Do you need me? Will you never leave me? Will you make me so happy for the rest of my life? Will you take me away? Will you make me away? Do you love me? Will you love me forever? Do you need me? Will you never leave me? Will you make me so happy for the rest of my life? Will you take me away? Let me sleep on it, baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Let me sleep on it, I'll give you an answer in the morning. Let me sleep on it, baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Let me sleep on it, I'll give you an answer in the morning. Let me sleep on it, baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Wait all night. What's it gonna be, boy? Yes or no? What's it gonna be, boy? Yes or no?
Let me sleep on it, baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Well, let me sleep on it.
It's Radio Fax 6205 12255 and for the winter in the UK 3910. Today, Sparks, our weekly programme of technical, media and scientific news, presented by Andy Burnham, Trevor Brook and Martin Dealey.
Taken from Computer Weekly, Thursday, December the 5th. Mirror Group accused of PC software piracy. Software piracy officials say that 4 out of 5 packages on 400 PCs at Mirror Group newspapers are illegally copied. The allegation from the Business Software Alliance, the BSA,
which represents UK and US software houses, follows a raid at five London Mirror Group newspaper offices. At a subsequent High Court hearing on Monday, the BSA obtained an injunction against Mirror Group newspapers, preventing the company from making, using, or disposing of any software that is alleged to have been copied. The injunction will continue until settlement of the writ issued against Mirror Group newspapers by BSA for alleged copyright infringement. BSA counsel John Baldwin said in court that a 9-hour audit discovered 670 of 800 copies of software checked appeared to be infringing copyright. But Mirror Group newspapers counsel Christopher Carr said his client strongly denied the allegations of breach of copyright and objected to them being ventilated in open court when the proceedings were at an early stage. The BSA says that 50% of all software used on PCs in the UK is illegally copied. It adds that research conducted last year highlighted a financial loss of £300 million a year in the UK for software houses. The Mirror Group newspapers raid was conducted by a 28 staff on behalf of five BSA members: Aldus, Autodesk, Lotus, Microsoft and WordPerfect. The five offices searched belong to Mirror Group newspapers, MGN, The European and the Daily Mirror newspapers. BSA European Council Bradford Smith says that although a large proportion of Mirror Group newspapers' computers were searched, some laptop PCs and computers in use during the raid have yet to be audited. Within the next 7 days, the court says Mirror Group newspapers must conduct a rigorous audit of all its software in use throughout its offices, and the results handed in to BSA and the court. Just like a company who buys drawing pins, pens and pencils, so it should pay for its software in a lawful way, says BSA Vice President Fox Bergerhoff-Mulder. We hope this case shows other firms what will happen if they continue to copy our members' software. Smith says that Macintosh software piracy is another major concern and has led to a number of publishers being targets of the BSA.
That from Computer Weekly, and made doubly embarrassing for the Mirror Group by the fact that they have their own MirrorSoft, or did have a few years ago, making software for personal computers such as the Spectrum, BBC Micro and so on. They had a publishing package themselves, so they know exactly what they're doing, or should be doing. We'll be right back.
Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D. Test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen. Tony Prince in 1966. Other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s. And you'll hear too memorable Caroline commercials and jingles. And about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, P.O. Box 53121 at 1007 RC, Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, P.O. Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, the legend lives on.
In Radio World, Multiple D's Benefits by Bruce Bartlett and Jenny Bartlett. A multiple D microphone, built with several sound entries or holes in the housing at different distances behind the microphone capsule, is designed to provide many sonic benefits to broadcasters. In fact, it is indispensable. To explain what a multiple D means, first consider how a directional microphone works. Every directional microphone, such as a cardioid, has at least two sound entries or ports, one in front of the diaphragm and one behind. The front entry feeds sound to the front of the diaphragm, while the rear entry feeds sound to the rear. The rear entry gives the microphone its directional properties. Sound waves approaching from the mic from the rear enter the rear port first, then they travel to the front of the microphone, entering the front port. Inside the rear port is an acoustic RLC phase shift network. It consists of an acoustic resistance, i.e. a bit of fabric, covering the short tube which leads into a cavity. In a cardioid microphone, this network delays the sound waves inside the rear port, so they arrive at the diaphragm the same time as the sound waves reaching the front port. As a result, sound waves push on opposite sides of the diaphragm at the same time, that is in phase. So the diaphragm does not move, and consequently the mic produces little or no signal. This is how the microphone cancels sound from the rear. This type of construction is referred to as single D, because the mic has one rear entry point at a single distance D from the front of the diaphragm. One unavoidable property of any single D directional microphone is that it has proximity effect. This is a progressive rise in bass response as the mic is placed closer to the sound source. For example, when a single D microphone is 2 feet from a sound source, its low frequency response is flat, or rolls off. But when the mic is 2 inches from the sound source, the low frequency response rises, giving a bassy or boomy effect. So the tone quality of a single D mic changes depending on the working distance. If an announcer talks too close to the microphone, the voice becomes unnatural, sounding or tubby. To prevent this problem, the multiple D microphone was invented. It has multiple rear sound entries at varying distances from the front of the diaphragm. Each entry responds to a different frequency band. Because of this construction, the multiple D mic greatly reduces proximity effect, so that the tone quality of the voice stays natural at any miking distance. This development has a long history. In the late 1950s, Electrovoice engineers invented the 666 and 664 multiple D microphones, which had three rear ports, each separately tuned to lows, mids and highs. In the 1960s, Electrovoice developed the continuously variable D microphones, RE15 and RE20, which had a slotted tube along the side of the handle. This design greatly improved the performance and ease of manufacture. The RE20 is probably the industry standard DJ announce microphone, not only because it is big and looks impressive, but because it sounds natural close up. The microphone also has a big diaphragm, which reduces sensitivity to breath pops. Lou Burrows from EV single-handedly converted the broadcast industry from RCA ribbon mics to EV variable D mics. Because of this switch, the broadcast tone quality of announcers changed from hollow or boomy to natural. AKG and Shure also produced multiple D models, the AKG D200, D202 and D224, and the Shure SM53 and SM54. And a few years ago, the D202 was one of the standard ILR microphones in this country, though it's since been surpassed by other models. The AKG models are unique in that they were two-way designs. Each microphone has a low-frequency capsule and high-frequency capsule in a single housing. When you talk very close to one of these AKG microphones, the high-frequency unit, closest to your mouth, has some proximity effect around 500 Hz, giving a puffy tone quality, so these microphones should not be worked too closely. In addition to reducing the hollow quality or boominess, the multiple D design minimizes handling noise. The diaphragm of a multiple D mic is more highly damped than the diaphragm of a single D mic. Thus, higher damping reduces susceptibility to mechanical vibrations. The multiple D microphone gives a natural tonal balance at almost any distance, so you can use it close up without boominess. It also pops very little and has minimal handling noise, making it a great mic for handheld interviews. Just to be sure not to cover the rear ports with your hand, or the frequency response and polar pattern will be degraded. Note that an omnidirectional microphone has the same benefits: no proximity effect, low pop and low handling noise. The advantage of the multiple D microphone is that it's directional, so it rejects background noise and room acoustics. Multiple D microphones have saved the day for me a few times. Once I was asked to go into a factory and record several people describing their political views. The recording was for later broadcast over a local station. First, I tried a single D cardioid microphone, placed close to each person's mouth in an attempt to reduce pickup of background noise. The microphone did reject the noise, but the bassy voices and pops made the recording unusable. I switched to an Electrovoice RE15 with a foam pop filter. It sounded great. Natural bass, no pops, no background noise. If you use multiple D microphones, you can expect the same results. Bruce Bartlett, a microphone engineer and technical writer for Crown International, and Jenny Bartlett, a technical writer. That was in Radio World.
Taking a stand in which the British government is accused of breaking the Charter of Human Rights over the Offshore Pirate Radio Act, Andrew von Gamm gets his hands on documents from ZDF that claim the European Community is breaking the Charter and the Treaty of Rome. Many broadcasters who stand to lose out due to the European Commission's HD and D2 Mac directive have already announced their intention to begin litigation, should the directive be enforced. SES manager Dr. Pierre Merat has already announced that his company would be going to the Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, commenting, "In its present form, the directive finds itself in direct contravention to Article 10 of the European Charter of Human Rights." However, opposition from German public broadcasting organisations ARD and ZDF is more likely to distress the directive's supporters. ARD, German Regional Public Broadcasters Network, and ZDF, the Mainz-based station with more viewers than any other channel in Europe, are established allies. Together, they form the largest single broadcasting lobby in Europe and a powerful voice against the directive. ZDF's legal department, headed by technical director Albrecht Zimmer, has been kept busy collecting documentation for use in any future litigation against the Commission. Outlines of the arguments against the directive have been sent to Commissioner Pandolfi in a series of confidential correspondence and public statements, all of which have remained unanswered. documents handed to International Broadcasting show that the ZDF attack concentrates on two areas: contravention of the Charter of Human Rights and of the Treaty of Rome. ZDF regards the human rights issue to contain the more serious arguments. Article 10 of the Charter covers freedom of information where limitations are imposed only in the interests of public safety. In 1990, in the so-called Autonics case, the Strasbourg court ruled against the Swiss government when the Swiss post office tried to outlaw satellite receivers designed to pick up non-European transmissions. However, many countries still ignore this ruling, one example being the British Offshore Pirate Radio Act, which declares listening to pirate broadcasts to be illegal. ZDF has pointed out that supporting the mandatory introduction of D2MAC on certain types of transmissions and hindering the development of PAL and other standards serves only to support selected industrial interests. Upon examination of the Treaty of Rome, the ZDF legal team found not only that the directive contravenes the spirit of the treaty by hindering freedom of movement of goods and services, free competition, and creation of a single European market, but that there is, in fact, no legal basis for the directive. The German broadcaster argues that there are no legal or administrative systems that need coordination as a market already exists. Furthermore, there are no national boundaries for satellite footprints, and satellite transmissions help to dissolve boundaries. The Commission seeks to create national boundaries by requiring all sets to be D2MAC compatible once a two-thirds market share has been achieved in a member country, resulting in different laws in different countries in direct contravention of Article 2. The company also claims that there are no distortions in the existing free market for satellite receivers. ZDF, however, suggests how legislation could be made to work. The two-thirds market share should be raised to over 80% of all existing sets for the whole of Europe. Because of the non-compatibility of systems and, above all, dish sizes, the Commission must compensate consumers for re-equipping from PAL to DMAC. ZDF also states that the directive is too vague. For example, it seems to include ordinary terrestrial broadcasts in its description of terrestrial distribution networks. ZDF also suggests the Commission should make sure that PAL, D2MAC and HDMAC are fully compatible with one another and with existing equipment. ZDF has one last idea. Why not drop the directive altogether and just recommend D2MAC to those that like it? That way, the directive would become a suggestive. That by Andrew von Gamm in International Broadcasting.
Columnist in Electronics Design magazine and staff scientist at National Semiconductor, Bob Pease has a new book out, Troubleshooting Analog Circuits. Here's a chance to take advantage of his years of experience designing analog circuits and working the bugs out of them. This book is for you whether you're designing analog circuits at the board, box, system, or IC level. It's for technicians working alongside a designer, student electrical engineers, and teachers of analog design. Even one bug-finding technique recovered from the book more than pays for it. But the best part may just be in the reading. It's pure peas. Never before has such potentially dry material been so much fun to peruse. You may have to keep it locked in your desk, except when in use. The 208-page hardcover book is $32.95 and is published by Butterworth Heinemann. The address in America is 80 Montville Avenue, Stoneham, 02180. Telephone 800-366-2665. Or you can order the book by post for $35.95, including tax and shipping. The address for that, Robert Pease, 682 Miramar Avenue, San Francisco, California, 94112-1232. That review by Frank Goodenough, who's the editor of Electronics Design. Maybe that's why it's such a glowing review, but it does sound like a rather interesting book. Hello to Robert Marshall, who writes from Canterbury, Tyler Hill, Many thanks for the card and literature on Radiofax, together with your remarks. And he goes on to give us some reception reports, thanks, and all the best for a license, he signs off. And a couple of letters from Germany. First from Yu Warschwakor from Friedrichsdorf in Germany. He's listening on 6205 with a Grundig Satellite 500 with telescopic aerial. I'm a regular listener to your really interesting radio reports, especially Sparks. Well, thanks very much for that letter. And Stefan Schliepak, I think it's pronounced, from Frankfurt in Germany. Since many years, I'm tuning into faraway radio stations from all over the globe. I was able to tune into your signal aired on the shortwave band. I tuned in your new frequency and was surprised to find a very strong signal. I appreciate the program format. Hope you'll stay on the air. He's listening on 3910. I think a lot of us have been surprised as to how well the reception on that's been. With a JRC NRD525 receiver, and, as an antenna, a six-beam inverted V directed towards Asia and America for shortwave and AM, 60 metres above ground, length of the aerials from 15 to 45 metres. Quite a setup we've got there. Stefan Schliepak in Frankfurt.